Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Plotte in Washington, D.C.
Every Nigerian has a right to protect their rights. Whether students, lecturers, parents, they have a right to protect their rights.
Nigeria's Academic Staff Union of Universities, or ASU, says it plans to challenge the registration of two factional academic unions.
Barbaric and fratricide as people war in Liberia. We need to know the truth, justice, not only for the victims, but also for those who are alleged to have committed these crimes. We need justice. We need due process for all.
A consultant for the Liberia Law Society calls on the U.S. government to help expedite the establishment of a war crimes court in the West African country.
People simply wanted to determine their own lives, to make crucial decisions affecting their lives. What was achieved is that the white man went away, and there came in a black man who is worse than the white man at the time for independence.
And Uganda celebrates 60 years of independence Sunday. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Nigeria, the Academic Staff Union of Universities, or ASU, says it plans to legally challenge the recent registration of two factional academic unions. The group says their registration is illegal and appears to be an attempt by the government to divide the union that represents staff of universities in the country. The ASU embarked on a strike on February 14 after saying the government has failed to keep its promises since negotiations began several years ago. Professor Emmanuel Oshodeke, president of the Academic Staff of Universities, or ASU, says the group will continue the strike until the government meets all of its demands. They include the revitalization of all public universities, increased funding for state universities, and the payment of promotion arrears and allowances. For more on the group's legal challenge plans and the latest development, I reach Professor Emmanuel Oshodeke.
We are in the process of filing. Our lawyer is in the process of doing that, and we believe that by the Trade Union Act here, you cannot register two unions on the same sector, and their judgment all over.
So you remain confident that the federal government's registration of two factional academic unions is a violation of trade union laws? Is that the stance of the ASU?
Definitely. The law is there. Why now? You want to use it as a weapon to divide the union? It cannot be divided. These are just people who are just out to create the division within the system and down to the tune of government.
So what do you make of Minister Chris Ngege's statement explaining that the two bodies will exist alongside ASU, adding that the two associations will enjoy the rights and privileges accorded to other academic unions in the tertiary education system?
Is that supposed to be business minister? If you don't have anything underground, if you don't have anything that you are hiding, should that come from the minister? That's the question we should ask. So what he's doing is just creating, want to create problem all over. He has tried all the options and they have all failed. So he has gone for this one. It will fail also. Our members who are academics know what we want. The few you see there are those who are, in true sense, or not to be in the system, who are being used by the government. But it will not work.
But Professor Oshodeke, recently a court ordered ASU to go back. You said you are consulting your lawyers. Has a decision been made regarding that?
You see, we have filed an appeal at the appeal court. We have also filed for stay of execution. And according to our lawyers, with those ones, we have obeyed the law.
So what does that mean?
We are challenging in the court. So we'll let hear the challenge and see what comes out of it.
So in the interim, your members will stay out of the classrooms as the court adjudicates your challenge,
that is,
correct?
That is where we are now.
Prof, recently some university students have gone to block roads. They are calling for a quick resolution to almost a year of this strike. What is ASU's response to them?
Every Nigerian has a right to protect their rights. Whether students, lecturers, parents, they have a right to protect their rights. If that is the way the students want to protect their rights, I think they have access. They have the right to protect their rights. If they have been shut down for the system for 7-8 months, they have the right to protest. And Nigeria, as a democratic country, they have the right to protest.
There are calls for renewed talks to resolve all your concerns. I'm sure you've heard about those talks. What is ASUU's stance on that?
You see, all we are seeing about the court case, about other unions, is just being done by one man, the Minister of Labor. As we speak, we are in touch with the House of Representatives of Nigeria, and they are in touch with the President on how to resolve this issue amicably. The Pro-Chancellor, Committee of Pro-Chancellor, are in touch with the President on how to resolve it amicably. And the minister jumped to court. In a normal system, is that correct? If the President is interceding on an issue, should the minister run to court? And if you watch yesterday, you also heard from the Supreme Court, the Appeal Court yesterday, you heard from me, who directed the two lawyers to go back to their principal, which is we and government, to resolve this issue out of court. You heard it yesterday.
Does that mean that ASUU is ready to deal with this issue out of court, like the court is suggesting?
We didn't go to court. We are willing to talk, and we are still talking. It's just one minister that ran to court. We are willing to talk. We can resolve this issue in 2 days. If the government leaves the issue of court, leaves the issue of other unions and what have you, and concentrate on the issues for which we are outside, which they'll be dodging. Every day they come back, we can resolve this issue in 1 day. We believe that this intervention by the National Assembly will resolve this issue in a very near future. So this idea of running to court and create diversions will be out. This idea of trying to create more unions in the system just to create confusion will be out. They are confusion. They are just creating confusion, which is not necessary.
Professor Emmanuel Oshodeke is president of the Academic Staff of Universities, or ASUU. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. And legal consultant for the Liberia Law Society is calling on the U.S. government to use its influence with the West African country to help the administration in Monrovia expedite the establishment of a war crimes court. Samuel Kofi Woods, who is also a human rights lawyer, says President George Weah's call for the legislature to provide guidance is a ploy to delay the establishment of the court. His remarks come as U.S. Ambassador-at-Large for Global Criminal Justice Beth Van Schaak visits Liberia. Wood says the U.S. official should use her visit to remind the president about his commitment to establish the court. Human rights activists and defenders say a war crimes court will help address human rights violations during the Liberian Civil War and give closure to the victims. For more on the calls to establish the war crimes court in Liberia, I read Samuel Kofi Woods.
I've noted very well that her presence is to seek and obtain additional information from Liberians regarding our collective commitment to the establishment of a war crimes court and to address accountability for crimes against humanity and human rights violations during our civil war. And she made it very clear that this is left to Liberians to decide. And she also made it very clear that President Weah had made commitment publicly on this issue, and it is important to demonstrate America's or the U.S. commitment to partner and support Liberia in a decision and quest to achieve this very important objective.
The president and his government have said that they are looking to parliament to chart the way forward in terms of establishing a court to deal with human rights violations, especially human rights abuses during the Liberian Civil War. Some have welcomed as a positive development. What is your reaction to that?
The executive, led by the president, cannot leave this exclusively with the legislature. This must be a national commitment led by the president. In my personal view, this is a diversionary tactics intended to delay the process. In the matter of the draft, the law has remained at the House of Legislature for a very long period, for more than almost 2 years. And this has been delayed as opposed to other agreements and other initiatives that the executive wanted approved. I don't believe that this is a display of real commitment, but rather an attempt to delay the process. I hope that the visit of the U.S. Ambassador on War Crime will help to accelerate this process. I hope the message will be very clear that Liberians want closure to the barbaric and fratricide and civil war in Liberia. We need to know the truth, justice, not only for the victims, but also for those who are alleged to have committed these crimes. We need justice. We need due process for all. In this way, we can end impunity, and we can begin to build a foundation for Liberia that is founded on justice.
What do you think is the best way forward in order to establish this court or to deal with those human rights violations, as some of you have been pushing hard for?
Liberia has embarked on a process that includes restorative justice through the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. They concluded the report several years ago. They advanced a couple of recommendations. We expect that any good administration will pursue those recommendations and ensure that they are fully implemented. Those recommendations include not only issues of justice regarding retributive justice, but they include reparation for victims. Questions of distributive justice have been addressed in that report. So at the first level, we have the Truth and Reconciliation Commission report. I think that the government must move swiftly to begin to address those recommendations. At the second level, the question of establishment of a war crimes court become critical. And as we know, that falls under the question of retributive justice. Fundamentally, we expect that the recommended law that is before the legislature should be passed within the shortest period of time. That law encapsulates all of the provisions and recommendations that was developed by the Bar Association in Liberia. And I think if we can speed that up with proper review within the shortest period of time, with the support of the United States and the international community, we can set up a war crimes court that will begin to address crimes committed during the Civil War.
What do you think the U.S. government can do to help in this directive?
As the war crimes ambassador intimated, there are no legal bottlenecks. I think the question of the legal bottlenecks are non-existent almost. What is required now is the political will. And I think that with the historic relationship and the visit of the ambassador, much can be done to put political pressure and to use U.S. influence and greater influence to ensure that this is done. The U.S. government has acted in different ways of late, which can be admirable. As you know, there have been sanctions placed on some of our ministers for different reasons in Liberia. So I believe that there are several things that can be done to put pressure on the Liberian government to embark and to fulfill this important duty and obligation under international law.
Samuel Kofi Woods is the head and legal consultant for the Liberia Law Society. He spoke with me from here in Washington. Malawian President Lazarus Chakwera is calling for public unity to help develop the Southern African country. Speaking shortly following his return to the country from the just-concluded United Nations General Assembly in New York, the president called on politicians, activists, and all citizens to come together to develop the country. Supporters welcomed the president's statement as a call in the right direction, but critics say the president's remarks are hypocritical. They argue that as an opposition leader seeking to become president, he didn't put politics aside while campaigning against the previous government. For analysis and more reaction from the president's call, I reach George Peary. He is a former lecturer at the University of Livingstonia.
It is a good call if he will set the pace of how Malawians need to look at development and politics. Because if he will want his party to champion the development, I think the call will end up in vain, because Malawians are divided amongst the political parties, and if he himself will set a pace of recognizing Malawi as a nation, and that his call is to develop Malawi as a nation, then everyone will participate. But if he wants the party where he comes from to champion the agenda of development, then obviously all other parties will come in and will inform their members not to participate because it will be political. So it is the best that the president himself can do, or the model that he can shape for everyone to look at development of Malawi as a national issue, not as a political issue.
What do you think are the prospects of his call? Are people accepting this call after he made the statement?
People have accepted the statement with two views already. One, because they know as Tosalan's government, which he is the leader, and secondly, him as the state president. So there are two things that he needs to be very careful of there. Number one is that, is he championing it as Tosalan's government, or Tosalan's government agenda, or is it a state president's agenda? If you champion it as a state president's agenda, then he himself puts aside the party politics, because he is also a leader of a particular political party in the country, then all others will follow suit. But if he will want to champion this agenda as a politician and putting forward his political party's agenda, then definitely the members of other political parties will not take heed to what to this call. But if he will champion it as a government agenda, where he will not take side of his party, and when his party's members speak, he will silence them, because what happens in Malawi is that the members of his party may come in and bring in politics.
George, some people are saying that the president's call is hypocritical because he did not put politics aside as an opposition leader. Now that he is president, he is calling on fellow politicians and Malawians to put politics aside to develop the nation. They said he didn't do that when he was an opposition leader. Why should it be done for him now that he is leading Malawi? What are your thoughts?
That's exactly, Peter, what I'm talking about, that it is himself who has to set the pace of what should be done. If he does not understand himself that he is both a political party leader and also a national leader, if he can't distinguish his position on this call as a national leader, not a political party leader, then nobody will take him for serious that his call is genuine. Everybody will say he's hypocritical because he just wants to hide in the name of development, while he himself would want to champion the party politics for which he is a leader.
Some people are saying that it's a striking balance that it will be difficult to accomplish, knowing that he is still the leader of the Tonse Alliance. He is a politician as well as being the president of the country. You think it's possible he can carry that out?
It cannot be too difficult for him to do. If he himself would want to champion development, and whenever members of his party would want to show that it is their president, he has the right to stop them from saying so or so, because he would want participation of the whole country to rally behind what he has called them to do and do it well. But if he will not stop the members from his political party taking a leading role of frustrating people that their party's leader is the one who is championing, then definitely what we are going to see is tragedy, because development will not be possible. And that will really be very frustrating to Malawians.
George Piri is a former lecturer at the University of Livingstonia. He spoke with me from Nzuzu, Malawi. In Zambia, Zambia, the National Women in Politics platform says the police service needs equipment and modern infrastructure to meet its mandate to maintain law and order in the southern African country. It comes after the police arrested three suspects accused of kidnapping young girls. The police say ongoing investigations will lead to the arrest of those responsible. Local media reports 13 girls were kidnapped for at least 5 months. The escape of one girl led to the eventual freedom of the remaining 12. But critics say the police appear to have been slow to investigate the abductions. For more on the call for the police to be properly equipped and the release of the 13 girls, I reach Winnie Zalumis.
The women feel that it's our responsibility. When anything happens to a girl child, we are affected because these are the future leaders of the country. So the reaction from the women was that we have to speak on behalf of these children and ensure that whatever is done after they've been found, ensure that whatever is done concerning the capture of the abductors, the law should take its course and they should have stiff punishment. We are not going to rest until everything is done properly.
Winnie, some people are saying 5 months was too long a time for them to be gone missing or abducted, and that the police should have intensified efforts to locate these young girls and free them. The police say they are still conducting their investigations. What is your reaction to how the police reacted so far?
They're still investigating, yes. Yes, it's taken long. I'm sure even in the statement you saw that we said that it has taken 5 months. But, you know, there's processes when you are investigating. We can't know the details because this is a security thing. It's a security alert. So even the police, as they do their investigations, they don't involve the whole public. They've been working behind underground ever since the first girl was abducted. And I don't think it has been easy for them, because even before, you know, the girls were found yesterday, I believe 3 days ago, the police had been in that area. They had been in that area already. They were almost near the same house, asking questions. They were getting information. You know how it is with such things. The public, they talk to the public and they get information, and they were almost getting to that house, but they were just a few houses away in the same area. So 5 months is a long time, yes, but again, it's the way it was done. Even the area where they were, it's so near. It's a residential area, and no one can expect anyone to have the nerve to, you know, to keep young girls in a house locked up like that in a residential area. But it's just the way these people did it. They're criminals.
Some Zambians are saying the police will need help with modern equipment and infrastructure in order to enable them to be effective in maintaining law and order and carrying out such investigations to prevent future occurrences. What is your reaction to that?
Yes, and the police need to be assisted as well. It's difficult for them to do their operations when they don't have equipment. Our reaction is that the government needs to come in and give them whatever they need, the infrastructure and whatever equipment that's needed for them to do the, you know, investigations well, in good time, so that they're able to get to these criminals on time, not over a long period of time.
Does your group have plans of visiting these freed ladies?
Our group has got plans, yes. We're actually having a meeting tomorrow in the morning, and this will be one of our agenda items. There's no way we can have a meeting. There are so many issues we have to see to, but this is what is, it's very important for us to, you know, make a decision on how we're going to go about going to see these young ladies and seeing how we can also help. Even if we don't have the resources right now, but at least we'll be able to lobby on behalf of these young girls.
Some Zambians are saying that this occurrence of abducting of children is odd in Zambia. It does not happen in Zambia, and that the security agencies must step up their efforts to prevent future occurrences. What are your thoughts on that?
For sure, in Zambia, we've never had such a thing happening. But you know the way the world has changed. There are so many things that happen that have changed. So if these things happen in other countries, it can also happen in this country. You know, it shouldn't surprise people. But as a government, since we've got a new government in place, I'm sure they're going to be able to ensure that we have statutory instruments that can protect the citizens and the children in this country.
Winnie Zalumi is the chairperson of the National Women in Politics platform. She spoke with me from the Zambian capital, Lusaka. Uganda, opposition and civil rights activists say General Muhoozi Kainerugaba, the son of President Yoweri Museveni, should be court-martialed and stripped of his new promotion. They accuse the president of nepotism, saying he appeased Kainerugaba with a higher rank after replacing him as commander of land forces of the National Army. Their comments come after Kainerugaba stated on Twitter that he can lead his men to seize Kenya's capital, Nairobi, in 2 weeks. This prompted President Museveni to apologize to Kenya and its people for his son's statement. He also replaced his son as the commander of the land forces but promoted him to general. Some analysts say a statement by the president's son should be seen as personal and not the stance of the government or the army, although they may be uncomfortable. But others say his statement violated rules of behavior in the army and he should be sacked. For more reaction and the latest development, I read Godbear Tumushabe. He is a lawyer, policy analyst, social entrepreneur, and a prominent Ugandan civil rights activist.
There are two kinds of reactions from Ugandans. There are a number of Ugandans, many of them mainly cheerleaders of Muhoozi and his father. They don't see anything wrong with the tweets, and they actually think it is okay. On the other side, there are Ugandans who are reacting mainly with the highest level of cynicism, simply because they know that General Muhoozi is able to do what he's doing or say what he's saying simply because he's the son of his father and his father is president. And so there's serious cynicism here because many Ugandans know that any other UPDF officer doing a small fraction of what Muhoozi has tweeted would definitely be either be in jail or would already be in the court martial.
I understand some opposition groups and leaders want General Muhoozi either to be jailed, demoted, or even court-martialed for the Twitter rant. Your reaction?
One of the major things or major achievements of President Museveni was to develop an army from a ragtag Bush war army, capture power in Uganda. In 1995, when we made the constitution, there was an attempt to transform the Bush War Army into a national army. The Uganda People's Defense Forces, or UPDF, is created under the national constitution. And it has a very serious code of conduct, a very serious law that governs it. And therefore, the president has a responsibility to be able to account to Ugandans. How can a senior army officer behave the way Muhoozi has behaved, do the kinds of tweets that affect our relations with our neighbors, and then you relieve him of command and promote him to four-star general? The kinds of contradictions that the entire decision that the president has taken is simply unbelievable.
Godbear, some analysts are suggesting that a decision or suggestions by some leaders of the ruling NRM party to choose President Museveni as the candidate for the next general election might have incurred the displeasure of General Muhoozi, who they believe might want to represent the NRM in the next general election when his father supposedly retires from political office. What are your thoughts about the suggestions?
I would really say that that analysis is totally unfounded. I think it's based on a lack of understanding of the current political trajectory in the country. I must concede that there are people that are excited about the possibility of Muhoozi being the next president. I think you've heard probably the birthday parties that have been going on. there are young people that are excited about it. But you see, recently, Ekuriga and I published a paper essentially looking at the transition scenarios in this country. And our central argument is that Museveni's mental programming is that he's a life president, so he will die in power. Anybody who thinks that Museveni is going to surrender power to his son, I still believe that President Museveni is not going anywhere. He's not ceding that space to anybody within his enclave.
Godbear, what is your take on suggestions that the president had appeased his son by giving him a higher position, promoting him to a general, while removing him as the commander of the land forces of the UPDF in Uganda?
There are standard rules on how people are promoted in the military. I don't think that the UPDF is a unique institution from any other military institution. There are procedures, there are rules on how people are promoted. So I don't really think that it makes a difference that you have spent 2 weeks on Twitter, rambling on Twitter, and then you are appointed the four-star general, and that applies to whether it is General Muhoozi or any other officer. So what Museveni has been able to do is to be able to do things simply because they please him. I don't think that even if Museveni didn't promote Kinerugaba, I don't think that there would be anything that he would lose as a president.
Godbear Tumushabe is a lawyer, policy analyst, social entrepreneur, and a prominent Ugandan civil rights activist. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. Uganda marks 60 years of independence on Sunday, October 9th. All East African community heads of state are expected to attend the celebrations slated to take place at Kololo Independence Grounds in the capital, Kampala. Ibrahim Semuju Nganda is a Ugandan member of parliament and spokesperson of the opposition party, the Forum for Democratic Change, or FDC. He tells my colleague Douglas Mpuga that there is little excitement among the general population about the anniversary.
There is a very big disconnect between the leaders and the population. So it is just the leaders that are preparing for the independence. I have passed by the Kololo Independence Square, so the military and the prison and police are preparing the marches that will characterize the day, but the population is not bothered.
Are the Ugandans where they're supposed to be 60 years after independence, you think, in your opinion?
You see, the clamor and fight for independence was not necessarily a clamor against white rule. People simply wanted to determine their own lives, to make the crucial decisions affecting their lives. What was achieved is that the white man went away, and there came in a black man who is worse than the white man at the time for independence. So the country's resources are still being embezzled. The leaders are still treating the country as if it is an enterprise of a leader and his wife and children. So really, the objective for which people fought and advocated for independence, the objectives have not been met. The only objective that has been met is that the British rule ended and it was succeeded by some mercenaries who are working more or less like they are serving the same interest.
Is it fair for some people to assert that maybe just after independence, social services were better in the country than they are today?
Of course, the British were in charge of this country for a very long time, but they laid the foundation, and there are examples to see. The country's referral hospital at Mulago was constructed in 1961 by the British. We've never added any. Instead, I sit in the parliament, you get requests by a government to give people money to construct similar facilities, but they are not there. The road infrastructure may have increased what is paved, but for every $1 that is invested, almost three are stolen. the health care is bad. The education is going down. We are a country that if today you held a referendum to ask Ugandans whether they want to return under the BTU, I think you'll get 80% saying we'll go back.
Given that situation, what do Ugandans have to reflect on this coming Independence Day anniversary?
People continue fighting for their independence. They are still being captured on the streets of Kampala, detained in ungazetted places. Some have disappeared. So this would be like a film. The leader of the country and his AD is going to call independence grounds to mark the 6 years of independence, but the population will not be bothered, and he knows it. And that's why there are no signs on any street in Kampala that the population is joining.
Ibrahim Ssemujju Nganda is a Ugandan member of parliament and spokesperson of the opposition party, the Forum for Democratic Change, or FDC. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Mpuga from the capital, Kampala. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, the World Bank says Kenya's external debt stands at $36.4 billion and its public debt about $71 billion, well over half of the country's gross domestic product. Economists say debt is likely to rise before the end of the year after what they described as a flurry of unbudgeted spending in the final days of Uhuru Kenyatta's presidency. For VOA, James Shimanyula tells us more about the administration's economic challenges from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
The coordinator of Kenya's Institute for Social Accountability, Wanjiru Gikonyo, is well-versed in economics. She explains how the country acquired its external debt.
Over-reliance on imports because of wrong spending priorities that were funded by expensive debt. A lot of that debt is in hard currency. Kenya's debt crisis has been fueled by the wrong priorities, wrong borrowing framework, and also corruption.
Independent observers say the country's external debt has risen or worsened because of the continued fall in the value of the Kenya shilling and the economic hardship that followed the COVID-19 restrictions. Some say the rate is due to high demand for U.S. currency by importers of petroleum products, fertilizers, and wheat, which has vastly surpassed earnings from diaspora remittances and tourism. The currency rate has made exports more expensive for foreign customers. Economists say the debt is likely to rise before the end of the year after what they describe as a flurry of unbudgeted spending in the final days of Uhuru Kenyatta's presidency. Gikonyo discloses some of the other issues her Institute for Social Accountability discovered during recent research.
The debt problem really is linked to the fact that we borrowed expensively in the external and domestic markets and put that money in projects that have not given returns. Some of those projects are white elephants. And then, of course, now with the Ukraine war and the global dynamics around the strengthening of the shilling, the high increasing cost of food imports on which we are reliant, the situation has been exacerbated. The wrong macro policy, the wrong fiscal policy, the wrong spending priorities, really, government mismanaged the economy and did not give us any cushion to deal with the external shocks.
Gikonyo says Kenya's economy does not compare favorably with that of neighboring East African neighbors, Uganda and Tanzania.
Kenya has been losing market share regionally because, unfortunately, Kenya's economy has some structural problems. We've got very high cost of power. We've also got very high cost of fuel. We've got a high cost of inputs. We've got a lot of production inefficiencies. This is making us uncompetitive regionally. We have a very high budget deficit. We've exceeded deficit because the East African community, I think, puts it at around 3.54% as the ideal deficit, and Kenya has been doing double. So when we compare with the regional partners, definitely Kenya has a lot of work to do because there's a lot more fiscal discipline in the Uganda and Tanzania markets. We are importing food from Tanzania. We are also importing from Uganda.
All economic news is not bad news. A report by one of the world's leading independent real estate agencies, Knight Frank, says Kenya's gross domestic product is currently projected at 5.5%. Economists say the rate is respectable, but lower than last year's 7.5%. For VOA News, I'm James Shimanyula in Nairobi.
Now it's time for music from our African collection.
Yeah.
Music from the continent, and we hope you enjoy it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Nadia Taha, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, rain does not make friends with anybody. It falls on any person it meets outside. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.